This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The Eerie Adventures of the Lycanthrope Robinson Crusoe. Written by Peter Klines. Performed by Tim Gerard Reynolds.
My family, my nature, my first voyage. I was born on the last day of the full moon in the year 1632 in the city of York, of a good family, though not of that country, my father being a foreigner who had fled the Prince Archbishopric of Bremen and settled first at Hull. He got a good estate by merchandise, and leaving off his trade, lived afterwards at York, from whence he had married my mother, whose relations were named Robinson, and from whom I was called Robinson Crysan. By the usual corruption of words in English, we are now called, nay, we call ourselves, and write our name, Crusoe. I had two elder brothers, both of the same bloodline and inheritance as myself. One was lieutenant colonel to an English regiment of foot in Flanders, commanded by the famous Colonel Lockhart, and was killed at the battle near Dunkirk, when he was run through with a silver sabre. What became of my second brother I was never told, though I was led to guess he had succumbed to the life of the beast, afore I was old enough to know him. Being the third son of the family, and bred with the wild blood of my sire, my head began to be filled very early with rambling thoughts. My father had given me a competent share of learning, and designed me for the law, but I would be satisfied with nothing but going to sea. My inclination led me so strongly against the commands of my father, and against all the entreaties and persuasions of my mother and other friends, that there seemed to be something fatal in that propension of nature tending to the life of misery which was to befall me. My father, a wise and grave man, gave me serious counsel one morning against what he foresaw was my design. He asked me what reasons more than a mere wandering inclination I had for leaving his house and my native country, where I had a prospect of raising my fortune by application and industry, with a life of ease and safety. Mine, he said, was a life of legend, hidden by necessity, one ruled by the moon and her brilliance, one which he had found was best suited to a quiet life of stability and routine. He bid me observe it, and I should always find the calamities of life were shared among the upper and lower part of mankind. The middle station had the fewest disasters. Peace and plenty were the handmaids of a middle fortune. This way, men went silently and smoothly through the world, and comfortably out of it, not embarrassed with the labours of the hands or of the head, not harassed with perplexed circumstances, which robbed the soul of peace and the body of rest, nor hunted by the mobs of townfolk and churchmen, not enraged with the animal passion of the beast, or the secret hunger for flesh. After this, he pressed me earnestly, and in the most affectionate manner, not to play the young man, not to precipitate myself into miseries which the life I was born in provided against. He would do well for me, and endeavour to enter me fairly into the station of life which he had been just recommending to me. To close, he told me, I had my elder brother for an example, to whom he had used the same earnest persuasions to keep him from going into the Low Country wars, but could not prevail, his young desires prompting him to run into the army, where he was killed. Though my father said he would not cease to pray for me, yet he would venture to say to me that if I did take this foolish step, God would not bless me, and I would have the leisure hereafter to reflect upon having neglected his counsel, when there might be none to assist in my control or recovery. I observed in this last part of his discourse the tears run down his face very plentifully, especially when he spoke of my brother who was killed. When he spoke of my having none to assist me, he was so moved, he broke off his discourse and told me his heart was so full he could say no more to me. I was sincerely affected with this discourse, as indeed who could be otherwise? I resolved not to think of going abroad any more, but to settle at home, according to my father's desire. But alas, a few days wore it all off. In short, to prevent any of my father's further importunities, a few weeks after, I resolved to run quite away from him. It was not till almost a year after this I broke loose, though in the meantime I continued deaf to all proposals of settling to business, and frequently expostulated with my father and mother about their being so determined against what they knew my inclinations prompted me to. Being one day at Hull, where I went casually and without any purpose of making an elopement at that time, one of my companions, Jacob Martens, then going by sea to London in his father's ship, prompted me to go with them with the common allurement of seafaring men. It should cost me nothing for my passage. I consulted neither father nor mother any more, not so much as sent them word of it, leaving them to hear of it as they might. In an ill hour, God knows, on the 1st of September 1651, the day after the last night of the moon, I went on board a ship bound for London. Never any young adventurer's misfortunes, I believe, began sooner or continued longer than mine. The ship was no sooner gotten out of the Humber, but the wind began to blow and the waves to rise in a most frightful manner. As I had never been at sea before, I was most inexpressibly sick in body and terrified in mind. I began now seriously to reflect upon what I had done, and how I was overtaken by the judgment of heaven for leaving my father's house and abandoning my duty. All the good counsel of my parents, my father's tears, and my mother's entreaties came now fresh into my mind. My conscience reproached me with the breach of my duty to my father. All this, while the storm increased and the sea went very high, though nothing like what I have seen many times since. But it was enough to affect me then, for I was but a young sailor. I expected every wave would have swallowed us up, and every time the ship fell down in the trough or hollow of the sea, I thought we should never rise more. In this agony of mind, I made many vows and resolutions. If it would please God here to spare my life this one voyage, if ever I got once my foot upon dry land again, I would go directly home to my father, and never set it into a ship again while I lived. Now I saw plainly the goodness of his observations about the middle station of life. How easy, how comfortably he had lived all his days and nights, and never had been exposed to tempests at sea or troubles on shore. I resolved I would, like a true repenting prodigal, go home to my father. But the next day, as the wind was abated and the sea calmer, I began to be a little inured to it. The sun went down clear, and rose so the next morning. I had slept well in the night, and was now no more seasick, but very cheerful, looking with wonder upon the sea that was so rough and terrible the day before, yet could be so calm and so pleasant in a little time after. And now my companion, Jacob, who had indeed enticed me away, came to me and said, "Well, Bob," clapping me on the shoulder, "how do you do after it? I warrant you were frightened, weren't you, last night, when it blew up a capful of wind?" "A capful, do you call it?" said I. "It was a terrible storm." "A storm, you fool," replied he. "Do you call that a storm? Why, it was nothing at all. Give us but a ship and sea room, and we think nothing of such a squall of wind as that. But you're but a freshwater sailor, Bob. Come, let us make a bowl of punch and we'll forget all that. Do you see what charming weather it is now?" To make short this sad part of my story, we went the old way of all sailors. The punch was made. I was made drunk with it, and in one night's wickedness I drowned all my repentance and all my resolutions for my future. I had, in 5 or 6 days, got as complete a victory over conscience as any young fellow who resolved not to be troubled with it could desire. But I was to have another trial for it still, and Providence resolved to leave me entirely without excuse. For if I would not take this for a deliverance, the next was to be such a one as the worst and most hardened wretch among us would confess both the danger and the mercy. The 6th day of our being at sea, we came into Yarmouth Roads. The wind having been contrary and the weather calm, we had made but little way since the storm. Here we were obliged to come to anchor, and here we lay, the wind continuing contrary for 7 or 8 days, during which a great many ships from Newcastle came into the same roads, as it was the common harbour where the ships might wait for a wind for the river. We had not, however, rid here so long, but the wind blew too fresh, and after we had lain 4 or 5 days, blew very hard. However, the roads being reckoned as good as a harbour, and our ground tackle very strong, our men were unconcerned. But the 8th day in the morning the wind increased. We had all hands at work to strike our topmasts and make everything snug and close so that the ship might ride as easy as possible. By noon the sea went very high indeed. Our ship rode forecastle in, and we thought once or twice our anchor had come home, upon which our master ordered out the sheet anchor. So we rowed with 2 anchors ahead, and the cables veered out to the better end. By this time it blew a terrible storm indeed, and now I began to see terror and amazement in the faces even of the seamen themselves. The master, though vigilant in the business of preserving the ship, yet as he went in and out of his cabin by me, I could hear him softly say to himself several times, "God be merciful to us. We shall be all lost. We shall be all undone." So soft were his words that the Lord's name came to my ears as "gone," though I knew it was not. During these first hurries, I cannot describe my temper. I could ill resume the first penitence which I had so trampled upon. I thought the bitterness of death had been past, and this would be nothing like the first. But when the master himself came by me, as I said just now, and said we should be all lost, I was dreadfully frighted. I looked out, but such a dismal sight I never saw. The sea went mountains high and broke upon us every 3 or 4 minutes, and in the deep water tween the waves I glimpsed great shapes like pale eels, each the size and length of a goodly cottage. Our men cried out a ship, which rid about 1 mile ahead of us, was overrun by Chagoths, which I took to mean the high waves. 2 more ships, being driven from their anchors, were run out of the roads to sea, with not a mast standing. Towards evening, the mate and boatswain begged the master of our ship to let them cut away the foremast, which he was very unwilling to do, but the boatswain protested to him if he did not, the ship would founder. He consented, and when they had cut away the foremast, the mainmast stood so loose and shook the ship so much, they were obliged to cut her away also and make a clear deck. Anyone may judge what a condition I was in at all this, who was but a young sailor. But if I can express the thoughts I had about me, I was tenfold more horror of mind upon account of my former convictions, and having returned from them, than I was at death itself. These, added to the terror of the storm, put me in such a condition I can by no words describe it. But the worst was not come yet. The storm continued with such fury, the seamen themselves acknowledged they had never known a worse. We had a good ship, but she was deep laden and wallowed in the sea. The seamen, every now and then, cried out she would fall to the Chagoths. It was my advantage in one respect, that I did not know what they meant by Chagoths. However, the storm was so violent, I saw what is not often seen. the master, the boatswain, and some others more sensible than the rest, at their prayers, though the words and language of their prayers were unknown to me. When the boatswain saw me intruding upon their time with their lord and master, I was given a heated glare and sent away. In the middle of the night, one of the men cried out we had sprung a leak. All hands were called to the pump. At that very word, my heart died within me, and I fell backwards upon the side of the bed where I sat. However, the men roused me and told me I, who was able to do nothing, was as well able to pump as another. I stirred up and went to the pump and worked very heartily. While this was doing, the master, seeing some light colliers who would not come near us, ordered us to fire a gun as a signal of distress. I was so surprised, I thought the ship had broke or some dreadful thing had happened. We worked on, but it was apparent the ship would founder. Though the storm began to abate a little, it was not possible she could swim till we might run into a port, so the master continued firing guns for help. A lightship, who had ridded out just ahead of us, ventured a boat out to help. It was with the utmost hazard the boat came near us, till at last the men rowed very heartily and ventured their lives to save ours. Our men cast them a rope over the stern, which they took hold of. We hauled them close under our stern and got all into their boat. We were not much more than a quarter of an hour out of our ship, but we saw her sink. Then I understood for the first time what was meant by Shoggoths. I must acknowledge I had hardly eyes to look up when the seaman told me she was overrun. The shapes, like pale worms or caterpillars, tore at the hull and twisted upon the deck. From that moment, my heart was dead within me, partly with fright, partly with horror of mind, and the thoughts of what was yet before me. They rowed the ship beneath the waves, and the boatswain said another prayer to the Lord, whom he also muttered as, "Gone." While we were in this condition, the men yet laboring at the oar to bring the boat near the shore, we could see a great many people running along the strands to assist us. We made slow way towards the shore, nor were we able to reach it till, being past the lighthouse at Winterton, the shore falls off to the westward, so the land broke off a little of the violence of the wind. Here we got all safe on shore, and walked afterwards on foot to Yarmouth, where, as unfortunate men, we were met with great humanity by the magistrates of the town, who assigned us good quarters, and had money given us sufficient to carry us either to London or back to Hull, as we thought fit. But my ill fate pushed me on now with an obstinacy nothing could resist. Though I had several times loud calls from my reason to go back to Hull, I had no power to do it, even with the moon a week upon me. Certainly, nothing but some such decreed, unavoidable misery, which was impossible for me to escape, could have pushed me forward against the calm reasonings and persuasions of my most retired thoughts, and against two such visible instructions as I had met with in my first attempt. My comrade, Jacob, who had helped to harden me before, and who was the master's son, was now less forward. The first time he spoke to me, after we were at Yarmouth, which was not till 2 or 3 days, for we were separated in the town to several quarters, it appeared his tone was altered. Shaking his head, he asked me how I did, telling his father who I was and how I had come this voyage only for a trial, in order to go farther abroad. Master Martins turned to me with a very grave and concerned tone. "Young man," he said, "you ought never to go to sea any more. You ought to take this for a plain and simple token you are not to be a seafaring man." "Why, sir," said I, "will you go to sea no more?" "That is another case," he said. "It is my calling, and therefore my duty. But as you made this voyage for a trial, you see what a taste heaven has given you of what you are to expect if you persist. Perhaps this has all befallen us on your account, like Jonah in the ship of Tarshish. Pray, continued he. "What are you? And on what account did you go to sea?" Upon that I started, that he may be experienced in the ways of knowing the beast in mortal form, for it was 4 days for the first night of the moon, and the signs were most definitely upon me. Yet I was not certain of his meaning, for he seemed not afraid. So I told him but some of my story, of my defiance of my father, and of my inclinations against his wishes. At the end he burst out with a strange kind of passion. "What had I done," says he, "that such an unhappy wretch should come into my ship? I would not set my foot in the same ship with thee again for 1,000 pounds. This indeed was, as I said, the excursion of his spirits, which were yet agitated by the sense of his loss, and was farther than he could have authority to go. However, he afterwards talked very gravely to me, exhorting me to go back to my father and not tempt Providence to my ruin. "And, young man," he said, "depend upon it, if you do not go back, wherever you go, you will meet with nothing but disasters and disappointments, till your father's words are fulfilled upon you." We parted soon after, for I made him little answer, and I saw Jacob and his father no more. As for me, having some money in my pocket, I travelled to London by land. On the road, I had many struggles with myself. By the sun, I dwelt on what course of life I should take, and whether I should go home or go to sea. And by night, I let the beast come upon me, as it has been wont to do since the first moon of my 10th year, and it killed many sheep and a cow. My second voyage, my third voyage, my life among the Moors. I remained some time uncertain what course of life to lead. As I stayed a while, the remembrance of the distress I had been in wore off. As that abated, the little notion I had in my desires to a return wore off with it, till at last I quite laid aside the thoughts of it and looked out for a voyage. That evil influence which carried me away from my father's house hurried me into the wild notion of raising my fortune, and impressed those conceits so forcibly upon me as to make me deaf to all good advice. I went on board a vessel bound to the coast of Afrique, or, as our sailors call it, a voyage to Guinea. It was my great misfortune that, in all these adventures, I did not ship myself as a sailor. I might have learned the duty and office of a foremast man. I might, in time, have qualified myself for a mate or lieutenant, if not for a master. But as it was always my fate to choose for the worse, so I did here. Having money in my pocket and good clothes upon my back, I would always go on board in the habit of a gentleman, and so I neither had any business in the ship or learnt to do any. It was my lot, first of all, to fall into pretty good company in London, which does not always happen to such loose and unguided young fellows as I then was. I fell acquainted with the master of a ship who had been on the coast of Guinea. He was resolved to go again, having had very good success there. Hearing me say I had a mind to see the world, he told me if I would go the voyage with him, I should be at no expense. I should be his messmate and his companion. If I could carry anything with me, I should have all the advantage of it that the trade would admit. I embraced the offer and entered into a strict friendship with this captain, who was an honest and plain-dealing man. I went the voyage with him and carried a small investment with me, which, by the honesty of my friend the captain, I increased very considerably. For I carried about 40 pounds in such toys and trifles as the captain directed me to buy. This 40 pounds I had mustered together by the assistance of some of my relations, whom I corresponded with, and who, I believe, got my father, or at least my mother, to contribute so much as that to my first adventure. This was the only voyage which was successful in all my adventures, which I owe to the integrity and honesty of my friend the captain. Under him, also, I got a competent knowledge of the mathematics and rules of navigation, learned how to keep an account of the ship's course, take an observation, and, in short, to understand some things that were needful to be understood by a sailor. In a word, this voyage made me both a sailor and a merchant, for I brought home 5 pounds 9 ounces of gold dust for my adventure, which yielded me in London at my return almost £300. This filled me with those aspiring thoughts which have so completed my ruin. Yet even in this voyage, I had my misfortunes, too. I was continually sick, being thrown into a violent calenture by the excessive heat of the climate, our principal trading being upon the coast, from the latitude of 15 degrees north, even to the line itself. I also passed no less than 6 moons on board, and while 4 were hid in my cabin by the fierce fever which even quelled the beast, 2 I spent in the deep bowels of the ship's brig, clapped in irons. True, plain iron could not contain the beast, but my father had shown me, as a lad, how a few silver coins can be placed within knots and against locks, and thus they are rendered incorruptible before the beast's fearsome strength. I was now set up for a guinea trader. My friend, to my great misfortune, dying soon after his arrival, I resolved to go the same voyage again, and I embarked in the same vessel, once again after the last night of the full moon. Alas, I fell into terrible misfortunes in this voyage. Our ship, making her course between the Canary Islands and the African shore, was surprised in the grey of the morning by a Turkish rover of Sali, who gave chase to us with all the sail she could make. We crowded as much canvas as our yards would spread or our masts carry, but finding the pirate gained upon us and would come up with us in a few hours, we prepared to fight. He came up with us, bringing us just athwart our quarter, and we brought 8 of our guns to bear on that side and poured in a broadside upon him. This then made him sheer off after returning fire, and pouring in also his small shot from near 200 men which he had on board. However, we had not a man touched, all our men keeping close. He prepared to attack us again, and we to defend ourselves. Laying us on board the next time upon our other quarter, he entered 60 men upon our decks, who fell to cutting and hacking the sails and rigging. We plied them with small shot, half-pikes, powder-chests and such, and cleared our deck of them twice. During this fighting, I wished I could call out the beast as my father has told me his father could, but alas, I was still young and foolish, and the nights of the full moon were still more than a week away. However, to cut short this melancholy part of our story, our ship being disabled, 3 of our men killed and 8 wounded, we were obliged to yield. We were carried into Sali, a port belonging to the Moors. I was not carried up to the Emperor's court, as the rest of our prisoners were, but was kept by the captain of the rover as his proper prize, and made his slave. At this surprising change of my circumstances, from a merchant to a miserable slave, I was perfectly overwhelmed. I looked back upon my father's prophetic discourse to me, that I should be miserable and have none to relieve me. Now the hand of heaven had overtaken me, and I was undone without redemption. But this was but a taste of the misery I was to go through. As my new patron, or master, had taken me home to his house, so I was in hopes he would take me with him when we went to sea again, believing it would some time or other be his fate to be taken by a Spanish or Portugal man of war, and then I should be set at liberty. But this hope of mine was soon taken away, for my patron, it seemed, knew the signs of my nature, and had kept me thus for himself. The day of the first moon, stout manacles, plated with silver, were brought, and in my patron's courtyard I was stripped naked and chained to a fountain. Many wise men and viziers came to view me and study me, for they had heard of Al-Mustazeb, which was their word for the beast. The moon rose, and the mantle of the beast came upon me. When this happens, my flesh is burned with unseen fire, and great aches and pains fill my limbs and jaw. The world is as if seen through a lens darkened with smoke, and heard as if a heavy woolen blanket wrapped round my head. Yet always I have no more freedom than a helpless passenger on a storm-wrecked ship with a mad captain, and that captain is the beast. I could see the wise men as they discussed my change and the beast before them, but their words were but noise, and to my intoxicated mind they looked like good, succulent meat does to a starved man. I could remember they did feed the beast a young lamb, but also pricked its flesh and plucked its fur and sketched it for their scrolls. The three nights passed, and I was left chained throughout. Yet during the day my needs were cared for. I was given wine and shade and fish and good flatbread, which they called pita. Here I meditated nothing but my escape and what method I might take to effect it, but found no way that had the least probability in it. On the morning after the third night of the moon, I was freed of the silver manacles, which had left welts and blisters on my flesh, and my clothes returned to me. I was then ordered by my patron to look after his little garden and do the common drudgery of slaves about his house. When he came home from his cruise, where he absent for a time, he ordered me to lie in the cabin to look after the ship. Thus it was for 4 weeks, until the moon was close again. Then the manacles appeared once more, and I was chained naked yet again, where the other slaves could not see me. Two of the wise men returned to witness my changes again, and with them three new scholars and a new vizier I had not laid eyes on before. This, then, is how each of my months passed in Sali. The wise men would study the beast each night of the moon, and I would feel the pain and rage of it at being chained and unable to run free as was its nature. The scholars would discourse with me during the day, and many of them spoke Spanish, of which I spoke only a little, and good King's English, of which I could, of course, speak freely, and they would ask many questions, viz., what was my name and my age, and for how long I had carried the beast within me, and of my history and family, and if they carried the beast as well. But my father had long instructed not to speak of family, and so these questions I would not answer. Many times in these conversations would come mention of a great book or work which they called Necronomicon. I asked of the nature of this work, but depending on which of the wise men I asked, each would give a different answer. One vizier called it a book of history, which told of things like the Al-Mustazeb, while another spoke of it as like a Bible, but for the worship of dark heathen gods. Still another told it as a book of magic, written by a sorcerer who had been driven mad by the writing of it. After about 2 years of this life, an odd circumstance presented itself which put the thought of making some attempt for my liberty again in my head. My patron used once or twice a week, sometimes oftener, to go out into the road a-fishing. He always took me, when it was between moons, and a young Moresco with him. We made him very merry, and I proved very dexterous in catching fish, insomuch that sometimes he would send me with one of his kinsmen and the youth to catch a dish of fish for him. Having the longboat of our English ship, he ordered the carpenter of his ship to build a little cabin in the middle of the longboat, like that of a barge, with a place to stand behind it to steer. She sailed with a shoulder of mutton sail, and the boom jibbed over the top of the cabin, which lay very snug and low, and had in it room for him to lie and a table to eat on, with some small lockers. It happened he had appointed to go out in his boat with two or three Moors of some distinction, and had therefore sent on board a larger store of provisions than ordinary, and had ordered me to get ready three fusees with powder and shot, for they designed some sport of fowling, as well as fishing. I got all things ready, as he had directed, and waited the next morning with the boat washed clean, her ensign and pendants out, and everything to accommodate his guest. By and by, my patron came on board alone, and told me his guests had put off going upon some business that fell out. He ordered me, with the man and boy, as usual, to go out with the boat and catch them some fish, for his friends were to sup at his house, and commanded, as soon as I got some fish, I should bring it home to his house. This moment, my former notions of deliverance darted into my thoughts, for now I found I was like to have a little ship at my command. My master being gone, I prepared to furnish myself for a voyage. My first contrivance was to make a pretense to speak to this Moor, to get something for our subsistence on board. I told him we must not presume to eat of our patron's bread. He said, "That is true." So he brought a large basket of rusk, or biscuit of their kind, and three jars with fresh water into the boat. I knew where my patron's case of bottles stood, and I conveyed them into the boat while the Moor was on shore, as if they had been there before for our master. I conveyed also a great lump of beeswax into the boat, which weighed above 50 weight, with a parcel of twine or thread, a hatchet, a saw, and a hammer. His name was Ishmael, whom they call Moly. So I called him. "Moly," said I, "our patron's guns are on board the boat. Can you not get a little powder and shot? It may be we may kill some alchemist for ourselves, for I know he keeps the gunner's stores in the ship." "Yes," he says, "I'll bring some." Accordingly, he brought a great leather pouch which held about 1.5 pounds of powder, and another with shot, and put all into the boat. At the same time, I had found some powder of my master's in the great cabin, with which I filled one of the large bottles in the case, which was almost empty, pouring what was in it into another. Thus furnished with everything needful, we sailed out of the port to fish. The castle, which is at the entrance of the port, knew who we were, and took no notice of us. We were not above 1 mile out of the port before we hauled in our sail and set us down to fish. The wind blew from the north, which was contrary to my desire. Had it blown southerly, I had been sure to have made the coast of Spain, and at least reached to the Bay of Cadiz. But my resolutions were, blow which way it would, I would be gone from that horrid place where I was pricked each moon, and leave the rest to fate. After we had fished some time, and catching nothing, I said to the Moor, "This will not do. Our master will not be thus served. I must stand farther off." Ishmael, thinking no harm, agreed, and set the sails. As I had the helm, I run the boat out near a league farther, and then brought her to as if I would fish. Giving the boy the helm, I stepped forward to where the Moor was, and I took him by surprise, with my arm under his waist, and tossed him clear overboard. He rose immediately, for he swam like a cork, and begged to be taken in. He swam so strong after the boat he would have reached me very quickly. I stepped into the cabin, and, fetching one of the fowling pieces, I presented it at him. Said I to he, "You swim well enough to reach the shore, and the sea is calm. Make the best of your way to shore, and I will do you no harm. But if you come near the boat, I'll shoot you through the head, for I am resolved to have my liberty." So Ishmael turned himself about and swam for the shore, and I make no doubt but he reached it with ease. When I was gone, I turned to the boy, whom they called Jury, and said to him, "Jury, if you will be faithful to me, I'll make you a great man. But if you will not swear by Mohammed and your father's beard to be true to me, I must throw you into the sea too." The boy smiled in my face and spoke so innocently I could not mistrust him. He swore to be faithful to me and go all over the world with me. While I was in view of Ishmael, I stood out directly to sea with the boat, rather than stretching to windward, so that they might think me gone towards the strait's mouth, as indeed any one that had been in their wits must have been supposed to do, for who would have supposed we were sailed on to the southward to the barbarian coast, where whole nations of negroes were sure to surround us with the canoes and destroy us, where we could never once go on shore but we would be devoured by savage creatures, or more merciless savages of humankind. But as soon as it grew dusk in the evening, I changed my course and steered south and by east, bending my course a little toward the east, that I might keep in with the shore. Having a fair, fresh gale of wind and a smooth, quiet sea, I made such sail that I believe by the next afternoon, when I first made the land, I could not be less than 150 miles south of Sali, quite beyond the Emperor of Morocco's dominions, or indeed of any other king thereabout, for we saw no people. My flight along the coast, Jury's terror, my salvation. Such was the fright I had taken at the Moors, and the dreadful apprehensions I had of falling into their hands again. I would not stop or go on shore, or come to an anchor. The wind continuing fair till I had sailed in that manner 5 days, I concluded if any vessels were in chase of me, they also would now give over. So I ventured to make to the coast and come to an anchor in the mouth of a little river, I knew not what, or where. Neither what latitude, what country, what nation, or what river. I neither saw nor desired to see any people. The principal thing I wanted was fresh water. We came into this creek in the evening, resolving to swim on shore as soon as it was dark and discover the country. But as soon as it was quite dark, we heard such dreadful noises of the barking, roaring, and howling of wild creatures of we knew not what kinds. The sounds carried no fright for me, for animals can smell the beast beneath my skin, and will most always shy away from my kind. But the poor boy was ready to die with fear, and begged of me not to go on shore till day. "Well, Jury," said I, "then I won't. But it may be we may see men by day who will be as bad to us as those lions." "Then we give them the shoot-gun," says Jury, laughing. "Make them run way." Such English Jury spoke by conversing among us slaves. However, I was glad to see the boy so cheerful, and I gave him a dram, out of our patron's case of bottles, to cheer him up. After all, Jury's advice was good, and I took it. We dropped our little anchor and lay still all night. I say still, for we slept none. In 2 or 3 hours we saw vast creatures of many sorts come down the seashore and run into the water, wallowing and washing for the pleasure of cooling themselves. They made such hideous howlings and yellings that I never indeed heard the like, even from the beast. Jury was dreadfully frightened, and indeed so was I too, for I bethought myself that the animals of a freak may not be aware of the beast, and would not avoid it. But we were both more frightened when we heard one of these mighty creatures come swimming towards our boat. We could not see him, but we might hear him by his blowing to be a monstrous, huge, and furious animal. Jury said it was a lion, and it might be so for aught I know. Poor Jury cried to me to weigh the anchor and row away. "No, Jury," said I, "we can slip our cable with the boy to it and go off to sea. They cannot follow us far." I had no sooner said so, but I perceived the creature, whatever it was, within 2 oars' length, which something surprised me. However, I stepped to the cabin door and, taking up my gun, fired at him. He turned about and swam towards the shore again. But it is impossible to describe the horrible noises and cries and howlings that were raised upon the noise or report of the gun, a thing I have some reason to believe those creatures had never heard before. This convinced me there was no going on shore for us in the night upon that coast, and how to venture on shore in the day was another question, too. To have fallen into the hands of any of the savages, which would not know the beast, would have been as bad as to have fallen into the hands of lions and tigers, and we were equally apprehensive of the danger of it. Be that as it would, we were obliged to go on shore somewhere or other for water, for we had not a pint left in the boat. When or where to get it was the point. Jury said if I would let him go on shore with one of the jars, he would find if there was any water and bring some to me. I asked him why he would go, why I should not go and he stay in the boat. the boy answered with so much affection that made me love him ever after. Said he, "If wild mans come, they eat me, you go away." "Well, surely," said I, "we will both go, and if the wild mans come, we will kill them. They shall eat neither of us." So I gave Jury a piece of rusk bread to eat and a dram out of our patron's case of bottles. We hauled the boat in as near the shore as we thought was proper, and so waded to shore, carrying nothing but our arms and 2 jars for water. I did not care to go out of sight of the boat, fearing the coming of canoes with savages down the river. But the boy, seeing a low place about 1 mile up the country, rambled to it. By and by, I saw him come running towards me. I thought he was pursued by some savage, or frighted with some wild creature, and I ran forward towards him to help him. But when I came nearer, I saw something hanging over his shoulders, which was a creature he had shot, like a hare, but different in color and longer legs. However, we were very glad of it, and it was very good meat. But the great joy poor Jury came with was to tell me he had found good water and seen no wild mans. But we found afterwards we need not take such pains for water. For a little higher up the creek, we found the water fresh when the tide was out, which flows but a little way up. So we filled our jars and feasted on the hare we had killed and prepared to go our way, having seen no footsteps of any human creature in that part of the country. My hope was, if I stood along this coast till I came to that part where the English traded, I should find some of their vessels upon their usual design of trade that would relieve and take us in. By the best of my calculation, this place where I now was must have been that country which lies waste and uninhabited except by wild things, the negroes having abandoned it and gone farther south for fear of the Moors. The Moors, not thinking it worth inhabiting by reasons of its barrenness, both forsaking it because of the prodigious number of tigers, lions, and leopards, and other furious creatures which harbour there. The Moors used it for their hunting only, when they go like an army, 2,000 or 3,000 men at a time. Indeed, for near 100 miles together up this coast, we saw nothing but a waste, uninhabited country by day, and heard nothing but howlings and roaring of wild creatures by night. We made on to the south for 10 or 12 days, living very sparing on our provisions, which began to abate very much, and going no oftener into the shore than we were obliged to for fresh water. My design in this was to make the river Gambia or Senegal, that is to say, anywhere about the Cape de Verde, where I was in hopes to meet with some European ship. If I did not, I knew not what course I had to take, but to seek for the islands, or perish there among the negroes. I knew all the ships from Europe which sailed either to the coast of Guinea, to Brazil, or to the East Indies, made this cape or those islands. In a word, I put the whole of my fortune upon this single point. Either I must meet with some ship, or must perish. Several times I was obliged to land for fresh water, and once in particular, being early in the afternoon, we came to an anchor under a little point of land which was pretty high. I was filled with concern for Jury, as this was to be the first night of the full moon, the first since our escape from the Moors. Several times during our voyage I had asked what he knew of the visiting wise men and viziers, but the boy knew only that they came to study with our former patron, and not at all of my nature, or my part in these studies. So I told him that I must go ashore for the night, into the higher country, and he was to wait for me on the boat and not follow. I would return in the morning. This upset Jury a great deal, and more so when he heard I would take no arms with me, for I did not want to risk losing my gun while the beast ran free. He cried and spoke dire warnings, and said I would not be safe without him. I assured him I would be fine, and had him remember I would be back on the shore in the morning. It upset him, but I knew he would obey my commands, so great was his love for me. As the sun set, I waded into shore and bade the boy to sleep well. I wandered till the shore was quite out of sight, and Jury could not see me as well. Here I removed what clothes I had, which was precious little, as I still wore the clothes of my servitude to the Moors, viz., breeches, waistcoat, linen shirt, and kerchief. These I placed in a tree atop a high branch, and walked still farther, exposed now, were any other man there to see. The sun went down, and it was but a few hours later that the moon rose, and the beast came upon me with great savage glee, for it sensed from deep within my skin it was not to be chained this night. As a rule, the first night of the moon is gentle, as that heavenly orb becomes full and true. But not this time, for after 2 years of silver chains, so quick it rushed out that I did scream from the pain of it, before its nature made me numb and distant. I know the beast took great joy that night, for it had never been amidst such savagery, and I knew its pleasure through the smoky haze of my dream, in the same way a man knows his horse or dog is happy and satisfied. It ran and killed and ate and howled, and ran more and killed more and ate more. This was a danger my father had taught against us, for to appease the beast makes it stronger, and gives it a better purchase upon one's thoughts and immortal soul. I awoke the next day on a patch of soft grass that had been pressed down, and made a most serviceable bed. A few scratches marred my arms and legs, but I was well rested and had no hunger, a fact I chose not to dwell on. It took but a short time to locate the tree with my clothes, left on the high branch just as I had placed them. I walked back to the shore, where Jory greeted me with joyous cries, for he told me the howls and screams of the night before had been far worse than any we had heard, and he feared I had met whatever fearsome creature he had heard, not knowing it was now within my skin while we spoke.
"He eat you at one mouth," said Jury.
"One mouthful," he meant. We made our way south for the day, and that night we again dropped anchor and I went ashore. Jury wailed again at my leaving, but not as much as before, and I once more spent the night in the high country of Afrique. The beast spent another night of savage debauchery beneath the moon, and when I came upon my own natures again, I was so deep in the forest I could not see the sun to acquaint myself with the cardinal directions. It was most unpleasant to me to spend hours walking unclothed in the forest like a savage. After some time I found a clearing and did orient myself, yet it was still well into the second half of the day when I located the tree with my clothes, but was most put out to discover they had fallen from the tree, and my good linen shirt was soiled by some creature. It being too late to return to the boat, I called out to Jory from shore. The boy was in a state, and from the sand I saw tears in his eyes. He cried out in joy, and begged me not to leave him again, for he was sure a great creature had eaten me up. I told him I must spend one more night in the high country, but in the morning we would resume our journey. He was most displeased at the thought of another night alone, and wailed for me to let him join me on the shore. I told him he could not, for he was small, and the creatures of Afrique truly would eat him at one mouth. I left him in tears on the boat, and travelled back away from the water. I was in process of storing my clothes in the tree again, but not my good linen shirt, which I had abandoned upon finding it soiled and foul, and had not yet removed my breeches when the sun set and the nature of the beast came over me. I did try to fight it off, for the binding of clothes angers the beast, but it was too eager to be free in the high country again. Through the smoked lens, I watched it struggle and fight with the breeches, and become more and more savage by their simple constrictions. The beast killed many creatures that night, and in my dreams were the dim memories of a dreadful monster that it fought with for close on an hour. afore it fell to the inhuman power of the beast's claws and teeth. I woke in the shade, and the first thought was I was not in the high country, for there was white sand beneath me. I still wore my breeches, though they were rent and torn, to be all but useless to me. They too had been soiled, as was my good linen shirt, though these by the beast. I started at once, for next to me on the sand was a terrible great lion, on its side as if asleep in the morning sun. I felt great fear for a moment, but then saw it was dead and could not hurt me. Indeed, one leg was torn right off, as one would tear apart a roast fowl, and much of the meat of its stomach was gone. The claw marks and teeth marks were most familiar to me, and left me with no question that the beast had dispatched this great lion. I stood up, and now saw the lion had been felled and lay between myself and the coast, and there was my boat just offshore, and there was little Jury staring with wide eyes and trembling with a great fear in him. He stood upon our boat's little deck, holding in his hands our biggest gun, which was almost musket bore. He stared at me, as one does at awful things, and I knew in his eyes his kind and goodly master now was an awful thing, for I could but suppose what he had seen in the night, and now come the morning. I waved to him, and spoke kind words, and told him to be not afraid, but still he shivered and held the fusee. At last I ordered him to shore, and to bring the hatchet from the cabin. This firm tone helped calm him, and, taking the little hatchet in one hand, he swam to shore with the other hand, coming close to me, though still his eyes were wide. I bethought myself that perhaps the skin of the lion might one way or other be of some value to us. I resolved to take off his skin, if I could. Jury and I went to work on him, but Jury was much the better workman at it, for I knew very ill how to do it. Indeed, it took us both up the whole day. But at last we got off the hide of him, and spreading it on the top of our cabin, the sun dried it in 2 days' time. It afterwards served me to lie upon. Jury would no longer sleep near me, nor did he smile or talk. I made forward for about 3 days more, without offering to go near the shore, till I saw the land run out a great length into the sea, at about the distance of 4 or 5 leagues before me. The sea being very calm, I kept a large offing to make this point. At length, doubling the point, at about 2 leagues from the land, I saw plainly land on the other side to seaward. I concluded, as it was most certain indeed, that this was the Cape de Verre, and those the islands called, from thence, Cape de Verre Islands. However, they were at a great distance, and I could not well tell what I had best to do, for if I should be taken with a gale of wind, I might neither reach one nor the other. In this dilemma, as I was very pensive, I stepped into the cabin and sat me down, Jury having the helm. On a sudden the boy cried out, "Master, master, a ship with a sail!" The foolish boy was frightened out of his wits, thinking it must be some of his master's ships sent to pursue us, when I knew we were gotten far enough out of their reach. I jumped out of the cabin and saw it was a Portuguese ship, and was bound to the coast of Guinea for negroes. But when I observed the course she steered, I was soon convinced they were bound some other way and did not design to come any nearer to the shore. With all the sail I could make, I found I should not be able to come in their way. They would be gone by before I could make any signal to them. But after I had crowded to the utmost and began to despair, they saw me by the help of their perspective glasses, so they shortened sail to let me come up. I was encouraged with this, and as I had my patron's ensign on board, I made a waft of it to them for a signal of distress, and fired a gun, both which they saw. Upon these signals, they very kindly brought to and lay by for me. In about 3 hours' time, I came up with them. They asked me what I was in Portuguese, and in Spanish, and in French, but I understood little of them. At last, a Scotch sailor who was on board called to me, and I answered him and told him I was an Englishman, and I had made my escape out of slavery from the Moors at Sali. Then they bade me come on board, and took me in, and all my goods. I immediately offered all I had to the captain of the ship as a return for my deliverance, but he told me that he would take nothing from me. All I had should be delivered safe to me when I came to the Brazils. "For," he said, "I have saved your life on no other terms than I would be glad to be saved myself. Besides," continued Captain Amaral, for that was his name, "when I carry you to the Brazils, if I should take you from what you have, you will be starved there, and then I only take away what life I have given." "No, no, Señor Inglese," "Mr. Englishman," said he, "I will carry you thither in charity, and these things will help to buy your subsistence there and your passage home again." As he was charitable in this proposal, so he was just in the performance. He ordered the seamen that none should offer to touch anything I had. Then he took everything into his own possession and gave me back an exact inventory of them, that I might have them even so much as my 3 earthen jars. As to my boat, it was a very good one, he saw, and told me he would buy it of me for the ship's use, and asked me what I would have for it. I told him he had been so generous to me in everything, I could not offer to make any price of the boat, but left it to him. Upon which he told me he would give me a note of hand to pay me 80 pieces of 8 for it at Brazil. When it came there, if any one offered to give more, he would make it up. Captain Amaral offered me also 60 pieces of 8 more for my boy Jury. I was very loath to sell the poor boy's liberty, who had assisted me so faithfully in procuring my own. Alas, the boy still often stared at me in fear, and it seemed much relieved at the sight of other men, even those not of his kind. However, the captain offered me this medium, that he would give the boy an obligation to set him free in 10 years, if he turned Christian. Upon my saviour's kind nature, and Jury saying he was most willing to go to him, I let the captain have him. My fortune's reverse, my plantation, my foolishness. We had a very good voyage to the Brazils, and arrived in the Bay de Todos los Santos, or All Saints Bay, in about 22 days, and 2 before the first night of the moon. Jury had tried numerous times to tell his new master and the crew of the beast within my skin, but his poor slave's English allowed me to brush aside his words as those of a small boy scared by the creatures of Afrique. I was once more delivered from the most miserable of all conditions of life, and what to do next with myself I was now to consider. The generous treatment Captain Amaral gave me I can never enough remember. He would take nothing of me for my passage, gave me 40 ducats for the lion skin which I had in my boat, and caused everything I had in the ship to be delivered to me. What I was willing to sell, he bought of me. In a word, I made about 220 pieces of 8 for all my cargo, and with this stock I went on shore in the Brazils. I had not been long here before I was recommended to the house of a good, honest man who had an ingenio, as they call it, that is, a plantation and a sugar-house. I lived with him some time, and acquainted myself with the manner of planting and making of sugar. Seeing how well the planters lived, I resolved that if I could get a license to settle there, I would turn planter among them, endeavouring in the meantime to find out some way to get my money, which I had left in London, remitted to me. To this purpose, I purchased as much land as my money would reach, and formed a plan for my plantation and settlement. I had a neighbour, a Portuguese of Lisbon, but born of English parents, whose name was Wells, and in much such circumstances as I was. My stock was but low, as well as his. We rather planted for food than anything else for about 2 years, and oft did he ignore the howls and roars that came from my estate at the time of the full moon. However, we began to increase, and our land began to come into order. The third year we planted some tobacco, and made each of us a large piece of ground ready for planting canes in the year to come. But we both wanted help. I was, in some degree, settled in my measures for carrying on the plantation before my kind friend, Captain Amaral, went back to England. When telling him what little stock I had left behind me in London, he gave me this friendly and sincere advice. "Señor Inglese," he said, for so he always called me, "if you will give me letters with orders to the person who has your money in London to send your effects to Lisbon, and in such goods as are proper for this country, I will bring you the produce of them, God willing, at my return. However, since human affairs are all subject to changes and disasters, I would have you give orders for but £100 sterling, which, you say, is half your stock, and let the hazard be run for the first. So if it comes safe, you may order the rest the same way." The merchant in London, vesting this £100 in English goods, such as the captain had wrote for, sent them to him at Lisbon, and he brought them all safe to me at the Brazils. Without my direction, for I was too young in my business to think of them, he had taken care to have all sorts of tools, ironwork, and utensils necessary for my plantation, and which were of great use to me. When this cargo arrived, I thought my fortune made, for I was surprised with the joy of it. Captain Amaral had also laid out £5 to purchase and bring me over a servant under bond for 6 years' service, and would not accept of any consideration except a little tobacco, which I would have him accept, being of my own produce. But as abused prosperity is oftentimes made the very means of our adversity, so it was with me. I went on the next year with great success in my plantation. I raised 50 great rolls of tobacco on my own ground, more than I had disposed of for necessaries among my neighbours. These 50 rolls, being each of above 100 weight, were well cured and laid by against the return of the fleet from Lisbon. You may suppose, having now lived almost 4 years in the Brazils, and beginning to thrive and prosper very well upon my plantation, I had not only learned the language, but had contracted an acquaintance and friendship among my fellow planters, most of whom had accepted my unusual and monthly hermitages. In my discourses among them, I had frequently given them an account of my 2 voyages to the coast of Guinea, and how easy it was to purchase for trifles not only gold dust and elephant's teeth, but negroes for service in great numbers. It happened, being in company with some merchants and planters of my acquaintance, 3 of them came to me the next morning and told me they had been musing very much upon what I had discoursed with them of the last night. They came to make a secret proposal to me, and, after enjoining me to secrecy, they told me they had a mind to fit out a ship to go to Guinea. They had all plantations, and were straitened for nothing so much as servants. As it was a trade that could not be carried on, because they could not publicly sell the negroes when they came home, they decided to make but 1 voyage to bring the negroes on shore privately and divide them among their own plantations. The question was whether I would go in the ship to manage the trading part upon the coast of Guinea. They offered me that I should have an equal share of the negroes without providing any part of the stock. This was a fair proposal, it must be confessed, had it been made to anyone that had not a plantation of his own to look after, which was coming to be very considerable, and with a good stock upon it. But for me, that was thus entered and established, and had nothing to do but go on as I'd begun for 3 or 4 years more, and could scarce have failed of being worth 3 or 4,000 pounds sterling, and that increasing too, to think of such a voyage was the most preposterous thing that ever man in such circumstances could be guilty of. But I, who was born to be my own destroyer, could no more resist the offer than I could restrain my first rambling designs when my father's good counsel was lost upon me. I told them I would go with all my heart if they would undertake to look after my plantation in my absence, and would dispose of it to such as I should direct if I miscarried. This they all engaged to do, and entered into writings or covenants to do so. I made a formal will, disposing of my plantation and effects, in case of my death, making Captain Amaral my universal heir. In short, I took all possible caution to preserve my effects and to keep up my plantation. Had I used half as much prudence to have looked into my own interest, and had made a judgment of what I ought to have done and not to have done, I had certainly never gone away from so prosperous an undertaking, and gone a voyage to sea, attended with all its common hazards, to say nothing of those needs and hazards posed to one such as myself. But I hurried on, and obeyed blindly the dictates of my fancy rather than my best reason. Accordingly, the ship fitted out and the cargo furnished, and all things done as by agreement by my partners in the voyage, I went on board in an evil hour again, the 1st of September, 1659, being the same day 8 years I went from my father and mother at Hull, in order to act the rebel to their authority, and the last day of the full moon at that. My fourth voyage, the unlocked door, shipwrecked. Our ship was about 120 tons burden, carried 6 guns and 14 men, besides the master, his boy, and myself. We had on board no large cargo of goods, except of such toys as were fit for our trade with the negroes, beads, bits of glass, shells and odd trifles, little looking-glasses, knives, scissors, hatchets, and the like. I had explained to the ship's master, through polite discourse, my occasional fits, which would require him locking me in my cabin on some nights, and that it would please me if he and his crew paid no heed to the sounds made at these times, as I was most embarrassed by the state to which these fits reduced me. While he thought this odd, he did not question it. The next day I went on board, and we set sail with design to stretch over the African coast. Keeping far off at sea, we lost sight of land, and steered as if we were bound for the Isle of Fernando de Noronha, holding our course. In this course we passed the line in about 12 days' time, and were in northern latitude when a violent tornado took us quite out of our knowledge. It blew us in such a terrible manner that for 12 days together we could do nothing but drive, and let it carry us whither ever fate and fury of the winds directed. During these 12 days, I need not say, I expected every day to be swallowed up. In this distress we had, besides the terror of the storm, one of our men died of the calenture, and one man and the boy washed overboard. About the 12th day, the weather abating a little, the master made an observation as well as he could, and found he was about 11 degrees north latitude, but he was 22 degrees of longitude difference west of Cape Sant'Agostino. He was got upon the north part of Brazil, beyond the river Amazons, toward that of the river Orinoco, commonly called the Great River. He consulted with me what course he should take, for the ship was leaky and very much disabled, and he was going back to the coast of Brazil. I was positively against that. Looking over the charts of the seacoast of America with him, we concluded there was no inhabited country for us to have recourse to till we came within the circle of the Caribbee Islands, and therefore resolved to stand away for Barbados. We could not make our voyage to the coast of Africa without some assistance, both to our ship and ourselves. With this design we changed our course, and steered away in order to reach some of our English islands, where I hoped for relief. But our voyage was otherwise determined, for a second storm came upon us, which carried us away with the same impetuosity westward, and drove us so out of the very way of all human commerce. Had all our lives been saved, we were rather in danger of being devoured by savages than ever returning to our own country. In this distress, the wind still blowing very hard, one of our men, late in the day, cried out, "Land!" We had no sooner run out of the cabin, in hopes of seeing whereabouts in the world we were, but the ship struck upon a sand. In a moment, her motion being so stopped, the sea broke over her in such a manner we expected we should all have perished. We were driven into our close quarters to shelter us from the very foam and spray of the sea. It is not easy for anyone who has not been in the like condition to describe or conceive the consternation of men in such circumstances. In a word, we sat looking upon one another and expecting death every moment, and every man acting accordingly as preparing for another world. There was little or nothing more for us to do in this. Our present comfort, and all the comfort we had, was that, contrary to our expectation, the ship did not break, and the master said the wind began to abate. Now, though we thought the wind did a little abate, the ship, having thus struck upon the sand, and sticking too fast for us to expect her getting off, we were in a dreadful condition, and had nothing to do but to think of saving our lives as well as we could. We had a boat at her stern just before the storm, but she was staved by dashing against the ship's rudder, and she broke away, and either sunk or was driven off to sea. We had another boat on board, but how to get her off into the sea was a doubtful thing, as the sun was all but gone. Alas, amidst these many words and crises, I was suddenly aware of the beast straining for freedom. So quiet had it slipped upon me on this first night of the moon, and was bid to ask the captain to lock me in my cabin before the fits came on to me again. The captain asked if I was maddened, for we fancied the ship would break in pieces every minute, and some told us she was broken already. To lock me away thus would condemn me to death, or so he believed. However, there was no room to debate, thus he ordered the mate of our vessel to imprison me as I requested, and such was our fate sealed. For the kind-hearted captain planned in secret, with the mate, to rescue me, against my wishes. The mate was not to lock the door, for once the other longboat was in the sea, they would rush upon me, bind me against the violence of my fits, and carry me to salvation. I knew none of this, but only that the beast was mere moments from rising up. I pulled off my own shoes and coats before I observed, to my horror, the door was as yet still unlocked. I cried out for the mate to fasten the hasp, but he had gone and laid hold of the boat, and with the help of the rest of the men, they got her flung over the ship's side and prepared to get in her. With my final clarity, I bethought myself that perhaps I should hurl my body from the rail, to God's mercy and the wild sea, rather than let the beast flee among good men, and so I fled from my cabin into the light of the moon. My vision grew dark, and my flesh hot as the mantle of the beast fell upon me, and I felt my hands upon the rail, and then no more. Merciful God has spared my mind from much of what transpired after this, but as always, I glimpsed and heard mere moments of what my beast experienced. It was much angered at finding itself clothed, and it howled and roared and tore at the rail. The mate and other man ran to the beast, thinking it was I in my fit, and tried to calm it with words afore they saw its face. The terror of Den Wilde Zee, as the Dutch called the sea in a storm, was naught compared to the beast. They fled in fear, and the beast killed the mate in a moment, falling on him as wolves do to lambs, tearing at his flesh until his blood flowed across the deck. And now the crew's case was very dismal indeed, for they all saw plainly they must face the beast or risk the high sea and the dark and distant shore they had glimpsed. being wise men all, they chose the distant shore and threw themselves into the boat. A raging wave, mountain-like, came rolling astern and broke over the deck, and the beast was driven from its kill. It slid across the tilted deck into the air and was all swallowed up in a moment, though I can recall a sight of the wave falling upon the longboat, much as the beast had fallen upon the mate. Nothing can describe the confusion of thought which the beast felt when it sunk into the water, nor is it easy to make sense from the many images my intoxicated mind saw through the smoked lens of the beast. It swam well, yet disliked water, and could not deliver itself from the waves so as to draw breath. It could not drown, for the beast is immortal, yet for purest silver, yet it could be thrashed and battered by the waves, and it was. At one point it felt land under its paws, yet the sea came back as a great hill of water, which buried the beast deep in its body and carried it back away from shore. There was much time as the beast fought with the sea. It would struggle to the shore, and then be either dragged back with a howl or pounded against the land, and this did happen countless times. One time would have been well nigh fatal to me, for the sea, having hurried the beast along, dashed it against a piece of rock with such force as to leave it senseless. But it recovered a little before the return of the waves, and held fast to the rock till the wave abated. Then the beast struck out again, and fetched another run up the shore, and the next wave went over it, and yet did not carry it away. The beast collapsed on the grass, free from danger, and quite out of the reach of the water. Its heart raced, and it panted for breath in the manner of a dog, with its tongue hung out. And then, for the first time in my life, the beast fell asleep beneath the moon, and spent its time in a deep, exhausted slumber, and I knew no more. My island, the ship, useful things. The next morning I walked about on the shore, lifting up my hands, and my whole being, as I may say, wrapped up in the contemplation of my deliverance. I reflected upon my comrades that were drowned, and that there should not be one soul saved but myself. As for them, I never saw them afterwards, or any sign of them, except three of their hats, one cap, and two shoes that were not fellows. I cast my eyes into the stranded vessel. The breach and froth of the sea being so big I could hardly see it, it lay so far off, and considered, Lord, how was it possible even the beast could get on shore? After I had solaced my mind with the comfortable part of my condition, I began to look round me, to see what kind of place I was in, and what was next to be done. I was wet, had no clothes to shift me, nor anything either to eat or drink to comfort me. Neither did I see any prospect before me but perishing with hunger. I had no weapon, either to hunt and kill any creature for my sustenance, or to defend myself against any other creature that might desire to kill me for theirs, though I hoped the creatures of this land would avoid me for the beast within my skin, as most animals of England do. In a word, I had nothing about me but a knife, a tobacco pipe, and a little tobacco in a box. This was all my provision, and this threw me into such terrible agonies of mind that for a good while I ran about like a madman. Night coming upon me again, I began, with a heavy heart, to consider what would be my lot if there were naught to eat in this country. All the remedy that offered to my thoughts at that time was to get what clothes I was left with into a thick, bushy tree, like a fir, but thorny, which grew near me, and consider the next day what death I should die, for as yet I saw no prospect of life. I walked about a furlong from the shore to see if I could find any fresh water to drink, which I did, to my great joy. Having drank, I went to the tree and put my clothes up in it, and presently the beast did come upon me again for the second night, that of the true full moon. While my own unwell state of thought made it most difficult to focus through the smoked lens, I was aware that the beast did feed, and if it could find food, there was hope I could as well. When I waked, it was broad day, The weather clear and the storm abated, so the sea did not rage and swell as before. What surprised me most was the ship was lifted off in the night from the sand where she lay by the swelling of the tide, and was driven up almost as far as the rock which I had first mentioned, where the beast had been so bruised by the wave dashing it against it. This being within about a mile from the shore where I was, and the ship seeming to stand upright still, I wished myself on board, that I at least might save some necessary things for my use. The first thing I found was the longboat, which lay, as the wind and the sea had tossed her upon the land, about 2 miles on my right hand. I walked as far as I could upon the shore to have got to her, but found an inlet of water between me and the boat, which was about 1/2 mile broad. I came back for the present, being more intent upon getting at the ship, where I hoped to find something for my present subsistence. While the beast had fed the night before on 1 or 2 creatures, I could not count on it again after tonight. A little after noon, I found the sea very calm, and the tide ebbed so far out I could come within 1/4 mile of the ship, and there I found a fresh renewing of my grief. I saw if the beast had not forced the crew to flee in terror, and all had kept on board, we had all got safe on shore, and I had not been so miserable as to be left destitute of all comfort and company, as I now was. This forced tears from my eyes again, but as there was little relief in that, I resolved to get to the ship. I pulled off my clothes, for the weather was hot to extremity, and took the water. When I came to the ship, my difficulty was still greater to know how to get on board. As she lay aground and high out of the water, there was nothing within my reach to lay hold of. I swam round her twice, and the second time I spied a small piece of a rope, which I wondered I did not see at first, hanging down by the forechains. With great difficulty I got hold of it, and by the help of that rope got into the forecastle of the ship. Here I found the ship was bulged and had a great deal of water in her hold. She lay so on the side of a bank of hard sand, or rather earth. Her stern lay lifted up upon the bank, and her head low, almost to the water. By this means all her quarter was free, and all that was in that part was dry. You may be sure my first work was to search and to see what was spoiled and what was free. First, I found all the ship's provisions were dry and untouched by the water. Being very well disposed to eat, I went to the bread room and filled my pockets with biscuit, and ate it as I went about other things, for I had no time to lose. I also found some rum in the great cabin, of which I took a large dram, and which I had indeed need enough of to spirit me for what was before me. Now I wanted nothing but a boat to furnish myself, and many things which I foresaw would be very necessary to me. It was in vain to sit still and wish for what was not to be had, and this extremity roused my application. We had several spare yards, and 2 or 3 large spars of wood, and a spar topmast or 2 in the ship. I resolved to fall to work with these, and flung as many overboard as I could manage for their weight, tying every one with a rope that they might not drive away. When this was done, I went down the ship's side and pulled them to me. I tied 4 of them fast together at both ends, as well as I could, in the form of a raft. Laying 2 or 3 short pieces of plank upon them crossways, I found I could walk upon it very well, but it was not able to bear any great weight, the pieces being too light. I went to work, and with the carpenter's saw I cut a spare topmast into 3 lengths, and added them to my raft with a great deal of labour and pains. But the hope of furnishing myself with necessaries encouraged me to go beyond what I should have been able to have done upon another occasion. My raft was now strong enough to bear any reasonable weight. My next care was what to load it with, and how to preserve what I laid upon it from the surf of the sea. But I was not long considering this. I first laid all the planks or boards upon it I could get, and having considered well what I most wanted, I got 3 of the seamen's chests, which I had broken open and emptied, and lowered them down upon my raft. These I filled with provisions. There had been some barley and wheat together, but to my great disappointment I found the rats had eaten or spoiled it all, As for liquors, I found several cases of bottles belonging to our skipper, in which were some cordial waters. These I stowed by themselves, there being no need to put them into the chests, nor any room for them. While I was doing this, I found the tide began to flow, and I had the mortification to see my coat, shirt, and waistcoat, which I had left upon the sand, swim away. My breeches, which were only linen and open-kneed, I swam on board in them, and my stockings. This put me upon rummaging for clothes, of which I found enough, but took more than I wanted for present use, for I had other things which my eye was more upon. It was after long searching I found the carpenter's chest, which was indeed a very useful prize to me, and much more valuable than a ship lading of gold would have been at that time. I got it down to my raft, even whole as it was, without losing time to look into it, for I knew in general what it contained. My next care was for some ammunition and arms. There were two good fowling pieces in the great cabin, and two pistols. These I secured first with some powder horns, and a small bag of shot, and two old rusty swords. I knew there were three barrels of powder in the ship, but knew not where our gunner had stowed them. With much search, I found them, two of them dry and good, the third had taken water. Those two I got to my raft, and now I thought myself pretty well freighted, and began to think how I should get to shore with them, having neither sail, oar, nor rudder. The least cupful of wind should have overset all my navigation. I had three encouragements. One, a smooth, calm sea. Two, the tide rising and setting into the shore. Three, what little wind there was blew me towards the land. And thus, having found two or three broken oars belonging to the longboat, with this cargo, I put to sea. For a mile or thereabouts, my raft went very well, only I found it drive a little distant from the place where I had landed before. I perceived there was some indraught of the water, and consequently I hoped to find some creek or river there which I might make use of as a port to get to land with my cargo. As I imagined, so it was. There appeared before me a little opening of the land, and I found a strong current of the tide set into it. I guided my raft as well as I could to get into the middle of the stream, but here I had like to have suffered a second shipwreck, for knowing nothing of the coast, my raft ran aground at one end of it, upon a shoal. Not being aground at the other end, it wanted but a little that all my cargo had slipped off towards that end that was afloat. I did my utmost by setting my back against the chests to keep them in their places, but could not thrust off the raft with all my strength. Neither durst I stir from the posture I was in. Holding up the chests with all my might, I stood in that manner near half an hour, in which time the rising of the water brought me a little more upon a level. A little after, the water still rising, my raft floated again, and I thrust her off with the oar I had into the channel. Driving up higher, I at length found myself in the mouth of a little river, with land on both sides, and a strong current or tide running up. I looked on both sides for a proper place to get ashore, for I was not willing to be driven too high up the river, hoping, in time, to see some ship at sea, and therefore resolved to place myself as near the coast as I could. At length, I spied a little cove on the right shore of the creek, to which, with great pain and difficulty, I guided my raft, and, at last, got so near as that, reaching ground with my oar, I could thrust her directly in. All I could do was to wait till the tide was at the highest, keeping the raft with my oar like an anchor, to hold the side of it fast to the shore near a flat piece of ground. As soon as I found water enough, for my raft drew about a foot of water, I thrust her upon that flat piece of ground, and there fastened or moored her by sticking my two broken oars into the ground, one on one side near one end, and one on the other side near the other end. Thus I lay till the water ebbed away, and left my raft and all my cargo safe on shore. My next work was to view the country. Where I was, I yet knew not, whether on the continent or on an island, whether inhabited or not inhabited. There was still a hill, not above a mile from me, which rose up very steep and high, and which seemed to overtop some other hills northward. I took out one of the fowling pieces, one of the pistols, and a horn of powder. Thus armed, I travelled for discovery up to the top of that hill, where, after I had with great labour and difficulty got up to the top, I saw my fate. I was on an island, environed every way with the sea. No land to be seen except some jagged black rocks, like cathedral spires neath the waves, which lay away off, and two small islands, less than this, which lay about 3 leagues to the west. I found also the island I was on was barren, and, as I saw good reason to believe, uninhabited, except by wild creatures. I saw an abundance of fowls, but knew not their kinds. Neither when I killed them could I tell what was fit for food and what was not. At my coming back, I shot at a great bird which I saw sitting upon a tree on the side of a great wood. I believe it was the first gun that had been fired there since the creation of the world. I had no sooner fired, but from all the parts of the wood there arose an innumerable number of fowls of many sorts, making a confused screaming and crying, every one according to his usual note. As for the creature I killed, I took it to be a kind of hawk, its colour and beak resembling it, but had no talons or claws more than common. Its flesh was carrion and fit for nothing. Contented with this discovery, I came back to my raft and fell to work to bring my cargo on shore, which took me up the rest of that day. What to do with it for this last night of the moon I knew not, nor indeed where to rest it. I was afraid to leave my cargo too revealed, for the beast had in the past committed wanton destruction on the things of men for no discernible reason. As well I could, I made a solid form with the chests and boards I had brought on shore, and made a kind of a wall for that night. As for food, I yet saw not which way to supply myself, except I had seen two or three creatures, like hares, run out of the wood where I shot the fowl. I knew for a certainty, if there were food on this island, the beast would find more of it. I removed my clothes as the sun dropped and stowed them within one of the seamen's chests. As the beast came upon me, I could not help but sense its pleasure to still be unchained and free in its new home. That night it killed two of the hares and feasted well on something larger, though I could not tell what. On the morrow, I now began to consider I might yet get a great many things out of the ship which would be useful to me, and particularly some of the rigging and sails, and such other things as might come to land. I resolved to make another voyage on board the vessel, if possible. And as I knew the first storm that blew must break her all in pieces, I resolved to set all other things apart till I got everything out of the ship I could get. Then I called a council in my thoughts as to whether I should take back the raft, but this appeared impracticable. I resolved to go, as before, when the tide was down, and I did so, having nothing but a checkered shirt, a pair of linen drawers, and a pair of pumps on my feet. I got on board the ship, as before, and prepared a second raft. Having had experience of the first, I neither made this so unwieldy nor loaded it so hard, but yet I brought away several things very useful to me. First, in the carpenter's stores, I found two or three bags of nails and spikes, a dozen or two of hatchets, and above all, that most useful thing called a grindstone. All these I secured together with several things belonging to the gunner, particularly two or three iron crows, two barrels of musket bullets, 7 muskets, and a large bagful of small shot. Besides these things, I took all the men's clothes I could find, and a spare foretopsail, a hammock, and some bedding. With this, I loaded my second raft, and brought them all safe on shore to my very great comfort. Having got my second cargo on shore, I went to work to make me a little tent with the sail, and some poles which I cut for that purpose. Into this tent I brought everything I knew would spoil, either with rain or sun. I plied all the empty chests and casks up in a circle round the tent to fortify it from any sudden attempt either from man or animal. When I had done this, I blocked up the door of the tent with some boards within, and an empty chest set up on end without. Spreading one of the beds upon the ground, laying my two pistols just at my head and my gun at length by me, I went to bed for the first time since the shipwreck and slept very quietly all night, for I was very weary and heavy. The night before, the beast had run long and hard, and I had labored very hard all day as well to fetch all those things from the ship and to get them on shore. I had the biggest magazine of all kinds now that ever was laid up, I believe, for one man. But I was not satisfied still. While the ship sat upright in that posture, I thought I ought to get everything out of her I could. So every day, at low water, I went on board and brought away something or other. The third time I went, I brought away as much of the rigging as I could, and also all the small ropes and rope twine I could get, along with a piece of spare canvas which was to mend the sails upon occasion, and the barrel of wet gunpowder. In a word, I brought away all the sails first and last, only I was fain to cut them in pieces and bring as much at a time as I could. They were no more useful to be sails, but as mere canvas only. But that which comforted me still more was that, last of all, after I had made five or six such voyages as these, and thought I had nothing more to expect from the ship that was worth my meddling with, I found a great hogshead of bread, three large runlets of rum or spirits, a box of sugar, and a barrel of fine flour. This was surprising to me because I had given over expecting any more provisions, except what was spoiled by the water. I soon emptied the hogshead of that bread and wrapped it up, parcel by parcel, in pieces of the sails which I cut out, and got all this safe on shore also. The next day I made another voyage, and now having plundered the ship of what was portable and fit to hand out, I began cutting the great cable into pieces, such as I could move. This was most unpleasant, for on her deck was the dark stain where the mate had fallen to the beast, which had not been entirely washed away by the sea, and now lay in my sight all the time while I worked. I got two cables and a hawser on shore, with all the ironwork I could get, including a set of manacles from the brig, were it ever needed to contain the beast on this island. Having cut down the spritsail yard and the mizzen yard, and everything I could to make a large raft, I loaded it with all those heavy goods and came away. But my good luck began now to leave me. This raft was so unwieldy and so overladen after I entered the little cove where I had landed the rest of my goods, not being able to guide it so handily as I did the other, it overset and threw me and all my cargo into the water. For myself, it was no great harm, for I was near the shore. But as to my cargo, it was a great part of it lost, especially the iron, which I expected would have been of great use to me. However, when the tide was out, I got most of the pieces of cable ashore and some of the iron, though with infinite labour, for I was fain to dip for it into the water, a work which fatigued me very much. After this, I went every day on board, and brought away whatever was left I could get. My new home, goats, my calendar. I had now been 13 days ashore, and had been 11 times on board the ship, in which time I had brought away all one pair of hands could well be supposed capable to bring. I believe, had the calm weather held, I should have brought away the whole ship, piece by piece. Though I thought I had rummaged the cabin so as nothing could be found, on my 12th visit I discovered a locker with drawers in it, in one of which I found two or three razors, and one pair of large scissors, and some dozen of good knives and forks. In another I found about 36 pounds value in money, some European coin, some Brazil, some pieces of eight, some gold and some silver. I smiled to myself at the sight of this money. "Oh, drug," said I aloud, "what art thou good for? E'en remain where thou art, and go to the bottom, as a creature whose life is not worth saving. However, upon second thoughts, I took it away. Wrapping all this in a piece of canvas, I began to think of making another raft. But while I was preparing this, I found the sky overcast, and the wind began to rise. In a quarter of an hour, it blew a fresh gale from the shore. It occurred to me it was in vain to pretend to make a raft with the wind offshore. It was my business to be gone before the tide of flood began, or otherwise I might not be able to reach the shore at all. Accordingly, I let myself down into the water and swam across the channel which lay between the ship and the sands, and even that with difficulty enough, with the weight of the things I had about me and the roughness of the water. The wind rose, and before it was quite high water, it blew a storm. But I got home to my little tent, where I lay with all my wealth about me very secure. It blew very hard all night. In the morning, when I looked out, behold, no more ship was to be seen. I was a little surprised, but recovered myself with this sudden